Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge high atop the Robert Morgan Building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia. It's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and tonight's special guest co-host, Clayton Sayre. Tonight's topic, the Omega Man. Well, hey everybody, welcome back to the old podcast. And tonight, yes, we are talking about one of my favorite all-time movies, The Omega Man. And joining us in the lounge via satellite is our special guest co-host, Clayton Sayre.
Well, you got what you want, Tiger. How does it feel?
No, not that movie. The other one.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Let my people go.
He'll get around to it before it's over. The right Chuck line for this one. But man,
well,
yeah.
I think there's not a lot of memorable.
No, he's, you know,
lines to me from this movie.
There's a lot of
it's an action type movie.
So. Yeah, there's a lot of dry one liners, him talking, you know, to himself or people that aren't there that are kind of funny, but. You know, this is one that's been a favorite of ours for years and years and years and years. It's one I've been wanting to talk about on here for a long time. And if I was going to do this one, it was going to be, you know, it was going to be with you. We were the ones that were going to do this movie
that's right.
on here. And, you know, this is such a fun movie. And it's one of my favorite movies. And it could be on a lot of different lists. It could be one of my favorite Chuck movies, one of my favorite science fiction movies, one of my favorite post-apocalyptic movies, I mean, you know, because it crosses over a lot of different subjects like that. But the one defining thing that holds it together above all else is Chuck.
Well, I mean, this is a movie that a lot of people are fond of. They recognize its shortcomings.
Oh, yeah. But you like it in spite of those.
It was that sort of a movie. You know, hit the right notes.
Yeah. Well, let's backtrack a little bit. So anybody who's not familiar with The Omega Man, it's actually the second time. Backtrack a little bit further. It's loosely based on the book I Am Legend. And this is the second time it was brought to screen. This is in 71. And the first time was The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price in the title role in 1964.
Right.
And I believe the book was written in 54. But yeah, what you said about people recalling this one fondly. I mean, even though the Vincent Price movie was really a lot closer to the book, this one has just stayed with people longer, I think.
Yeah, because of people of our age, they saw this. I mean, you know, it was all over TV, so, you know, they would have seen it all the time. But going back just a little bit, one of the things I think was pretty cool in looking up some stuff about this that I did not know.
Oh, yeah.
And that was that the Vincent Price, you know, when they made the book, the first option on the book was Hammer Studios.
Oh, really?
Which probably would have been Cushing.
Oh, yeah.
Devil. And the censors said no. Of course, this was before that censorship barrier broke down. So you look at the time of this, this was really before their they started doing their horror cycle. So it got bought up by this other group, and then they decided to do a much cheaper version, which is why they ended up shooting it in Rome.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know how that turned out.
Yeah.
I mean, the other is just a cheap production. But it's effective. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, the story's pretty faithful to the book, beat for beat.
Yeah, it's the closest one to the book, to Vincent Price.
Yeah.
But in updating it, they lose a couple things, you know, unfortunately. But
talk about the changes in it. And first off, anybody who's seen Omega Man knows that the family, the bad guys, are kind of albino, you know, mutated albinos in robes, dark, you know, robes with hoods, basically, like cult members type thing, which we'll touch on that a little later on. But it starts off, it's 1977 in the movie. It was made in 71, but in the movie it's 1977, and it's 3 years after a biological warfare between China and Russia. It's caused a plague that's wiped out just about everybody on Earth, except the people that are alive that we see at first. Anyway, The effects of the biological warfare has turned their skin pasty white with sores on it, and their hair white, and their eyes white. So they're like extreme albino looking and can't come out in the sun. They have to operate in the dark, so that's why they only come out at night, and during the day they sleep. Except for Heston, who was a military scientist trying to work on a cure for it when it first started, and through a series of events and a helicopter crash, he ends up injecting himself with this experimental serum.
He's immune.
Yeah, and it turns, and the serum makes him immune, yeah. And that was the only little bit it was that experimental batch, and, you know, he just had a syringe full, basically, in the helicopter when it crashed. So you go ahead to 77. He's driving around alone. He is the last man on Earth that he knows of. And by day, he tries to wipe out, find the nests of the family to wipe them out and go about his daily business of trying to stay alive. And at night, he holds up in his penthouse of his townhouse, his fortified townhouse in the city. And shenanigans ensue throughout the movie.
Yes.
They try to kill him each night. They're out in the streets shouting his name and catapulting. They won't use technology. They think that man and technology is what brought the world down. So they won't use modern technology. They use a catapult and try to launch firebombs at his apartment. They do this kind of stuff every night. And later on, Neville discovers, you know, one other person. He sees a woman running around in the city, and he tries to chase after her, and she gets away. He doesn't see her, and he thinks he hallucinated because he's been by himself so long. The family finally catches him at one point and gives him a mock trial, and they're going to execute him on, what is it, Dodger Stadium,
I think? Yeah.
And the girl that he found and another guy that's alive break him out of there and save him, and then take him back out in the hills where they're living. And he finds out there's a little house or commune with these two young adults and a bunch of children. That's Lisa, Rosalind Cash, the character of Lisa that he met, and finds out that her brother is sick with the plague, and he tells them, well, he's immune, so his blood can probably be used to make a cure. So they take him back to the city, the brother, with Lisa and Neville, and they end up curing him. And then him, like the brother, Richie, like a dumb teenager, thinks he knows everything. And God, I hate that character that shows up in all these movies and TV shows like that, and it constantly gets into trouble by doing stupid, thinking they know better than someone who's been around a long time. And he says, why don't you give them a cure? And he's like, they're beyond curing, or they won't take it. They won't believe that it's a cure. And so he goes out, starts in the day, but it ends up night by the time he gets there to there where the families hold up. Richie tries to explain to him, Neville's got a cure. And they're like, no, he doesn't. He wouldn't give it to us. He doesn't have one. You're lying. You're a spy for him. And they end up killing him. Neville finds out, goes on a rampage, and tries to get Richie and then take as many of the family members down as he can, and ends up getting betrayed by Lisa, who turns out all of a sudden she was out shopping during the day, and which is bizarre. She goes out there during the day, but she doesn't come back before dark, and he doesn't seem real concerned that she's out. But I guess it's all happening so fast at this point. It's supposed to be happening so fast. She's walking around, and all of a sudden the family's walking, chanting through the streets, and she just stops and starts saying what they're saying. And as she's unwrapping this turban thing on her head, you see her hair's all white and her face is pasty, and the plague has hit her. And they do say earlier in the film that sometimes it happens over a period of a couple days, sometimes it happens real fast. So they give you that out on that, why it happened so quick. And she ends up bringing the family to Neville's house. They trash his house and end up, at the end, Neville ends up dead. But the kids come by in the truck with Dutch, and he has the serum inside of his shirt, and he takes it out and hands it to him, and the kids ride off with the serum. So, like, they're going to live, but he's dead. And it's a striking image when he dies, which shows up a couple other times in the film, too. But that's a basic quick rundown of the plot without getting too, you know, detail-oriented.
I think that's good for everybody.
That's good with Fred.
Yeah. So, I guess, well, let's start with things that are a little different.
All right.
For this version specifically.
Yeah.
In the book. The biggest is the representation of the family.
Yeah.
I think. And why, you know, this has to do with when the movie was made.
Yeah. Well, the two writers were a husband and wife team, and I can't remember their names off the top of my head.
The Quarringtons, who wrote Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, okay. One of them was like a chemist, I believe. The wife was like a biochemist or something.
Right.
So she brought that element into it, thinking it would be more relevant for the time with all the scare and talk of germ warfare and things like that also.
Right.
So she changed it because originally in the book, they were more or less vampires, pretty much is what the plague turned them into.
Yeah, they pretty much are vampires in the book.
Yeah, they shamble around kind of like the living dead, like zombies in a way, but they're really vampires and they talk, they're intelligent and all that, and they taunt him every night.
Yeah. Now you have the book.
Somewhere around here. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. That element they changed, and probably for that time period, that was a smart move, I would say.
Yes, and well, maybe in 71. A few years later, though, we got a little resurgence with vampire stuff with Yorga and Blackula and such, you know. And Hammer was still cranking out a couple of more vampire films, too.
Right, but also by this time, Night of the Living Dead had come out, which was heavily influenced by
Last Man on Earth, yeah.
So, you know, it had done that, and I think they were just looking for what's a different approach for this material.
When, too, when you get Anthony Zerbe playing the leader of the bad guys, and he and Heston get a couple nice little scenes where they get to talk to each other. And not really even chewing scenery, but it's like nice little, you know, back and forth character bits between them.
Yeah.
And the vampires.
And Zerbe does a great job in this. And you can tell he has a lot of fun with it. It's interesting that he was a newscaster. His character was newscaster the previous life. So that it maybe explains why people surrounded him, because he was a TV personality. You know, they knew who he was.
Yeah, people will follow and believe things by people they think they trust.
Yeah, and you figure at that time in newscasting, you know, I remember them always used to say the most trusted man in America was Walter Cronkite.
Walter Cronkite, yeah, and they were in your living room every evening.
Right.
You know?
So I thought that was kind of a cool way to get
there,
because in the other version, he's the neighbor.
Yeah, and why he became sort of
the
leader, the
neighbor,
who knows? But in this version, it makes sense, because he had that charisma and already had followers in a way beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's important for you to believe that very quickly they were able to form a group of people.
Yeah.
So that sets the tone for that. Then you have underlying this kind of the Black Power movement.
Yeah.
And I've always seen this written about Omega Man. And Chuck talks about this in his book that, you know, they work that in both sides. You know, of course, you have Lisa, Rosalind Kapp, who was coincidentally almost played by Diana Carroll.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. that was a bit of trivia I uncovered.
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
Beforehand. Yeah, because this was Rosalind Cash's first role, wasn't it? First film role, anyway.
Yeah. We'll get to that in a minute. There's a little bit of fun thing. And you'll remember that from that Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We're definitely going to talk about that in a second, yeah. But, yeah, she was the... I don't want to say they made her out to be kind of the stereotypical Black Panther, a Black Power poster child.
Yeah,
for this.
Yeah.
The way she looked and really dressing in the leather and, you know, and her hair and kind of her attitude a bit. But
I think so.
Very relevant. Very relevant for the time, though.
Yeah, but that's one element that dates it. A little bit, unfortunately. Other stuff that dates it, too.
Yeah. But, you know, that's part, I mean, for me, I mean, you just said dates it, unfortunately. But for me, I don't think of it as unfortunately. I think that's part of its charm, is it is kind of a time capsule of when it was made. And any shortcomings that it has relating to that, I can forgive because of the time it was made. It puts me in that setting of watching it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me. It just... As far as I think any science fiction film from the 70s is hurt a little bit, because the ones that tended to show the near future.
Yeah.
That's difficult. And because we bypass it so quickly, too, that you realize, well, they weren't even close.
Yeah. Yeah. I love 60s and 70s future sci-fi stuff because of that. I think it's charming to go, aw. You know, thought that was going to be something really wild in the future, and that's old now, and it's not even the time they were talking about.
Exactly.
I mean, God, and our cell phones have got more technology than anything that's ever shown up on Star Trek at this point.
Oh, yeah. But that part of it is, is evident when you watch it. But her role is it's a good role. There's some plot holes with her as far as, like what you said, she's able to go out in the dark and then and not. You know, some of that is a little wonky.
Yeah. You know, I read a little bit, doing a little research on this, I read a little thing about her being a bit apprehensive and nervous about having the scene with Heston.
I love this quote.
The pseudo love scene. Yeah. where, because she grew up watching Charlton Heston in the movies, and he was, you know, this larger than life character playing these larger than life roles, and she has to do this love scene with him. He didn't see the big deal because, you know, Chuck has always been, he's an actor, you're an actor, you know, we're doing a job here, you know, that's all. But she said, the quote is something like, she said it was just having to do the love scene with him, it was just a little off-putting having to screw Moses.
Yeah.
I love that. Oh, man, and really, you know, there is no love scene, really. I mean, there's they share a kiss, you know?
Yeah.
They flirt a bit and they share a kiss, but which is very important in cinema history because it was probably the first interracial on-screen kiss on the movie screen. On the movie screen, I don't think
it's the first.
It was one of the first.
It's one of the first, I think, with such a major.
Yeah, it's one of the highest profile ones, anyway.
Yeah, with such a major player, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, because the first TV one was Shatner and Uhura, wasn't it? Once again, bringing it back to Shat. But this is all about Chuck.
Because if you don't give a shat,
then we don't give a shat about you.
That's right. You've got to give a shat.
That's right. Man, that's what we need, a remake of this with the Shat. And we're not even going to talk about the third time it came to the screen, the third.
Okay. Well, you know, there are things I liked about that I thought were really, really nicely done.
Yeah.
The biggest thing I hate are the creatures themselves. There's nothing to them. I mean, there's
just a CGI mess.
You need to hear a little bit about them and to see, because in the book and in, I can't remember if they, in Last Man on Earth, if they talk about this, but in the book is the idea that if Neville is the last man on Earth,
yeah,
and then you have these other people, there would be a first generation. So let's say in Omega Man, you have Zerby, the people about his age, or the new people,
yeah,
or the most recent, or the, you know, as they have kids, or as this strain, this disease or virus continues, they will, in essence, create a new type of person.
Yeah.
So Heston's not the last man on Earth. He's not the monster. They are, to him.
Yeah.
But to them, he is. He's the one with a virus. He's the one that doesn't fit in.
Yeah, because he's the minority. They become the majority. Everybody is alive except Heston is, in the book anyway, is a vampire. More or less, than Neville. Let's just say the character, than Neville, is a vampire. And he goes around during the day when they're asleep or hibernating and is killing them. Yeah. So he becomes, to them, he becomes the boogeyman. Or he becomes legend. That's where the title comes from. He realizes at the end that he's the monster. He's a legend to them. And,
right, and it's too bad that never comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, they never really say that, and they do in the Vincent Price movie in Last Man on Earth. They say that right at the end, like a voiceover kind of thing.
Right, I thought that did.
But in this, they don't even touch on that at all. But you do get a lot of Christ imagery in Neville.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, and some of it is
some of it's in your face. Some of it's kind of subtle, but
really hokey.
Yeah, I mean, you get that when they have him tied up at they're going to kill him at Dodger Stadium. Even his legs are together and kind of turned, like when you always see depictions of Jesus on the cross. His legs and feet are almost in the same position. And at the very end, when he gets killed in the fountain there, his arms are kind of down, but it's still in the cross kind of pose. And
that's the hokey one.
Yeah, and then the blood of Neville is what saves everybody.
Right.
So
yeah, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, they don't come right out and say it, but they say it. They visually, it's like, hey, here it is. You know? But that aside, it's really an enjoyable movie. I mean, from the beginning, when, you know, he's, and it starts right off with no title or anything, just the him driving through the desolate city, and he's the only one around. And there's long shots where you can see there's nothing going on, there's nobody there, and him, you know, wrecking his car and going in the dealership and talking to the corpse behind the desk about what do you get me for a trade-in? That much, huh?
Yeah.
Thanks, you cheating bastard. Yeah. And just having this conversation with nobody. It's really, I mean, it's really kind of sets it up and gives you a feeling of what's going on and how the movie's going to play out, you know? That sense of alone and loneliness. And then when he hears the phones ringing, but they're not ringing.
Yeah, that part, you know, is the stuff that I like the best. And that is one thing that in the remake, the Will Smith version,
yeah,
there's a little bit of that. And when they stick to that, it's really good. When they don't, it's really bad.
You know, I couldn't even bring myself to see it because I'm not really a big Will Smith fan. And I think it all stems back to when he, you know, he dissed you that time. but I mean, he's funny. Yeah, he's funny, and he's a good actor. He's just one of those guys that just doesn't appeal to me at all, you know. And I liked him in Men in Black, and he's funny, but I just don't care to see him anything else. And this, it was like, man, why? When I saw the trailers for it, and I'm like, no, it holds no interest for me.
The CG creatures and stuff is really its downfall. Where it stays, you know, to a decent story, then, you know, that's. Anyway, but we're talking about the Omega Man.
Yeah, which is, I mean, so, everything in this is a lot of fun, right down to the score. I love the music. I've got the soundtrack on CD. You know, I love the music in this, especially the action music when stuff starts to go down.
Oh, yeah.
it's good stuff. Ron, Grenier, I think? I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but yeah, you know, it's got just a real action feel to it. Something's happening right then.
Well, I love the fact that Chuck figured out a way to work jogging. You know, when you see him jog and you go, he was such an exercise guy.
And get his shirt off a couple times.
And get his shirt off. And he's running, you know, through that wooded area. You can't, there's a close-up that looks almost like it's from Apes.
Yeah, yes. I thought the same thing. Yeah, because he was fresh off of Apes when he made this.
Yeah, well, fresh off of Beneath.
Yeah, because this came out in 71, so they had to, have made it in 70. So.
Yeah, now, okay, we got to do some of our other degrees of association here.
okay.
Dave, Chuck, and Zerby, of course, Will Penny.
Will Penny, that's right, yes.
Here's one. I was looking up the cast.
Uh-huh.
The guy that is Zerby's right-hand man.
Oh, Lincoln Kilpatrick.
Yes, was in Soylent Green.
Yeah, that's right. I saw that, yeah.
Okay, then we got the Corrington, I said, battle. And you may not know this.
Yes.
But Chuck dies in this the same way he died in Cartoon.
Oh, really? Spear to the chest.
Yes.
Huh.
Spear to the chest. Yes, he died that way in Cartoon. So
Chuck didn't live through the 70s, did he?
No, he died in a lot of stuff.
I mean, he died in what? In Beneath, in this, in Soylent Green, in Cartoon, in what else did he do that he didn't make it out of in the 70s?
Does he die in Three Musketeers?
He made it out of that, I think. Yes, he did.
Okay.
But he was playing a bad guy, so.
Well, these the Clarringtons, what was it they massacred, of course, Battle.
Well, yeah.
I was trying to think what else they... Oh, Killer Bees. That's what it was. There was something else I saw that they did Killer Bees.
Was that the one with Saxon?
Yes.
Okay, because there's Killer Bees is a deadly bees.
Killer Bees is the one... It was the TV movie.
Yeah, okay.
With... Wait. Eddie Albert. wait a minute. Well... Kate Jackson, Gloria Swanson, Roger Davis. Craig Gibson.
We know Roger.
Yeah, we know Roger.
Yeah.
Well, you do.
Yeah, he's a nice fella.
Hey, he was nicer, even so, and I never met him personally, he was nicer to me than Will Smith.
That's true. That's very true.
Take that.
Take that, Fresh Prince.
That's dice. Someone else is in this movie that is a...
An Omega Man or Killer Bees? Which one are we talking about now?
Omega Man. Okay. Omega Man. Let's go back to Omega Man. That is a genre person.
Oh.
And I thought you might know who it is.
Well, Paul Coslow was all over blaxploitation films.
Well, yeah, Coslow was, of course, yeah, he was he was everywhere.
Yeah.
But this is Brian Tochi.
Oh, he's one of the little kids, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was one of the kids.
Man. Man, long before Space Command.
Oh, yeah.
Or Space Academy, rather. Space Academy.
Space Academy.
And long before he lended his voice to the Ninja Turtles.
That's right. And a lot of other stuff.
Man, Tochi, making the scene.
He does mostly, I guess that's what he does now.
Yeah. Now, looking this up and getting back to Rosalind Cash for a minute, did you ever know there was a deleted scene?
Yeah, at the grave.
Yeah, I never knew that, and it's not on the Blu-ray is bare bones. I mean, it's got a little featurette they filmed during the making of the film, and yeah, it's got a new introduction.
Well, they would have filmed something because there's a credit
for Woman in Cemetery, yeah. And the deleted scene is at some point after Neville and Lisa have their fling that night. I'm not sure if this is a couple days later or where this fits in, but she discovers that she's pregnant, and she goes to her parents' graves to basically talk to them and, you know, talk about her concerns and all that. And she hears a noise in the crypt near there, and so she goes to investigate, and she sees one of the family in this dark crypt laying an infant family member to rest, and she can see that the look on the woman's face is she's, you know, sad and crying because it was her child, and she just stands there and looks at her, and then she just turns around and leaves. When she gets back to Neville's townhouse, she tells him that she saw one of the family in a crypt in the graveyard today, and he says, well, did you take care of her? And she says, no, I can't. Let's see how she put it. Like, because I may be a mother in 9 months, I can't kill a grieving mother.
Right. She was pregnant.
Yeah, and Neville looks shocked, and then he embraces her, you know, happy, and then that's how the scene kind of ends. Apparently they filmed it. It's probably lost, but that would be something if that showed up on an anniversary Blu-ray or something.
There's, I think I saw one time someone had, filmed their own version of that scene.
Really? Wow. That'd be awesome to see. Man.
So, I think I came across it one time. It might still be on YouTube.
Oh, wow. I'll have to look for it then. If I find it, I will put that on the Facebook page. That's pretty awesome.
Now, you know, to shoot this thing, they had to shoot on, Sunday morning.
Yeah, any of the city stuff, especially because the blue laws were in effect back then, where places were closed on Sundays. So shooting in downtown L.A. and in the business district, I think is what it said, where nobody would be. Right. Early Sunday mornings, they shot a lot of that stuff. And I don't know if it and on holidays or something, I think I heard somewhere. But even so, in those long shots, if you look, you can see at one point, like one of the side streets, you see the front of a car kind of pull up to the corner off in the distance.
Yeah.
And Phyllis was watching it with me. She had said she even saw once in a while, when he's driving around in the distance, you see somebody walking around the corner or something.
Yeah, well, you can see, supposedly, I haven't gone back and watched this part anytime recently, but there were two parts I need to look. One, anytime he looks in his rearview mirror, if you look behind him, you might see something. The cars passing by and stuff.
Yeah.
Like on the intersections way back. But
yeah.
One, that opens. Scene where he's driving around, the credit sequence, he passes three different people on the street. And one of them, supposedly, is the one of the production people that's holding traffic from cutting through the intersection. So I'm going to go back and watch that now. I
love
this.
Oh, man, me too.
On a movie tube site. And I thought, oh, I got to watch that.
Man, yeah, I'm going to have to look for that. Because, you know, just watching it the other night, just trying to refresh myself with it, you know, I just got caught up in it and watching it and enjoying it, even knowing some of those things. I wasn't really looking for it, but I just got caught up in the enjoyment of watching it. And it moves at a pretty good clip. I mean, like I say, it sets up that isolationist feeling at the beginning for a little bit. And then when he pulls up to the house, boom, the action starts. And there you go.
Well, he was that Boris Segal, who was the director.
Yeah.
Didn't he do one of the Dirty Harrys?
You know, that sounds kind of familiar. I think he might have. And if I'm not mistaken, I think he was like Katie Sagal's dad from Married with Children. I think that's right. I could be right. He was somebody's dad, and since they shared the same last name.
He was Ukrainian.
Yes.
He was working on that TV miniseries, or the TV film, the World War III.
Oh.
Came out in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And he was, they were filming aerial shots, and he was killed in a helicopter. He got out of it, turned the wrong way, and the blade almost took his head off.
Oh, damn. Yeah, Vic Morrowed.
So he is the father of Katie Sagal.
Oh, okay. I was right. All right. Yeah.
Rich Man, Poor Man. Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. That was huge in the 70s.
Yes, but he's not the guy that did the Dirty Harry.
Okay.
The Dirty Harry. I thought it was just one of the Dirty Harry movies that he did. But
yeah.
It's not him.
Oh, okay. But he had a healthy body of work, though, before and after this.
Oh, yeah.
And he did a good job. You know, it moves along at a good clip. Heston, Heston's always gold in anything he's in. He's, you know, people joke about, you know, the clenched jaw, and when you go to see Heston in the film, you're seeing Heston in the film, you know. But he's really a damn good actor at making things just appear natural. That he's not, you know, doing lines. He's just the character saying what he's saying. That's just the character happens to sound like Charlton Heston, you know?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Chuck was limited. I mean, there were things he couldn't do very well.
Well, he couldn't play Asian.
He doesn't do low emotional scene very well.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that bit with him, between him and Rosalind Cash, where they're kind of sort of flirting, but he's a little awkward at it.
Yeah.
That plays out very well. I was watching it the other night and thinking about it while I was watching it, you know. Surprised at how just kind of natural it comes off of him in that.
Yeah, I mean, he was just, there's just some things he couldn't do.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, you know.
He didn't need to do them in the types of movies he was in.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't see Heston in, well, I don't know. It escapes me now. Trying to think of something you wouldn't see him in.
The best stuff that he's ever done is in Will Penny.
Oh yeah, well that was his favorite movie too. From what I remember,
I think it is his best performance.
But you know he plays low key in that too a lot.
It's a very low key, you know. But the movies he was in, he couldn't be low key. He wasn't supposed to be low key, and this is one of those ones where. He's the center.
Yeah.
He needs to be the center, and he needs to be believable that he could do all these things.
But, you know, he does. But in this one, though, it's a lot more low-key job of character than, say, Taylor in Apes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because in that, he's, like, fighting for his life constantly and trying to make sense of what's going on. In this... He's made sense of what's going on. He knows exactly what's going on. He's been going through it for 3 years now, and he's used to talking to himself and keeping himself company. And he's made not so much made peace with his fate, but this is what he's got to deal with, you know. And then
he's a good figurehead for a movie like this. You need somebody like that.
Oh yeah, you need that strong. Grizzled. I think that was probably my biggest thing with Will Smith. I wasn't buying him as this guy because you need the strong kind of world weary presence for this type of role.
Yeah, that was the part that the survivor part.
Yeah,
was a little harder to get behind.
Yeah,
but once you get behind him in it, it's just there's other problems with the movie, and so.
But this
in all three versions. They're not. I think the problem with this one is that it never touches on some of the parts that are in the book that are a little bit deeper. And it's too bad they don't do that. You know, like the part about he's been killing off the next generation of people.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. He gets. They don't really show that as much that he's hunting them. They allude to it, and I think they say it one time. But you don't see it happening. It just shows him going through and marking where they're not.
Yeah, you get the idea that he's going out during the day to restock and replenish, but never that he's really going out and tracking them down and killing them.
Yeah,
you kind of get an idea that he's tracking them down to find out where they are.
Yeah.
To keep tabs on them, but not one by one systematically killing them off.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one thing that did bug me, though, I would have liked to have seen, and of course this is, the director giving the actor direction of how to play a scene, was when he saw Lisa, okay, and the first woman he's seen in 3 years since the, that wasn't a family member, and there wasn't as much anguish or desperation in his attempt to try to contact her. You know, I mean, that first, wait, and he runs after her right there. But after that, I mean, I would like to have seen more of him pleading as he's running after her, like, don't go, please. I need to know you're real, that kind of thing. Except right at the end where he stops in the park, he sits on the bench and he starts talking to himself about, well, that's it, I'm going crazy,
Parts like that, and there's little parts of it. And you always hope that it's too bad they didn't have a little more of that. Little more of it.
I mean, other than that, though, I'd have no problem with his performance. Like I said, all the little subtle, like, kind of one-liners he says to himself when he's by himself really plays naturally. And when he's talking to Lisa in that first bit where they had dinner and they're kind of flirting before the kiss,
yeah,
I'm buying every bit of it coming off of him, and struggling. I mean, and granted, she was good in it, but you can tell she's a young actress, and it's probably one of her first roles in her delivery and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not as natural as Heston's is.
Well, this is a movie that is Chuck, Zerbe, and everybody else.
Yeah, pretty much.
The guy, that Lincoln guy that was his aide, he was good.
Yeah.
His delivery and stuff was really good.
Honky but Paradise, brother.
Everyone else, he's in there living it up.
No, brother, those were the old ways.
That's right.
I mean, Zerbe's great in anything, even if he's playing just a schlub. He, he's enjoyable to watch. But even in Kiss Meets the Phantom, he was fun to watch. There's one for you. But this, I mean, you have these two guys like that. Heston's such a strong presence. You buy him in this role. That, like you said, the survivor, the world-weary guy that's been through it all, and then Zerbe being the TV newscaster in everybody's living room, as being the leader and having enough charisma for everybody to follow him in this. And those were the two most important parts, like you say, in this. You have to have those to buy everything else that happens.
Do you know, before they did the Will Smith remake, who was going to tackle it?
Oh, no, who?
I remember Ridley Scott and Schwarzenegger.
Oh.
At that time. And I forget why it fell through.
Yeah.
Probably script, and then they just moved on to, they couldn't commit any more time.
Yeah.
But that would have been an interesting.
It would have been.
Visually, how Ridley Scott would have done the. Everything.
Yeah.
And what he would have brought to it, I think. And Schwarzenegger would have served the same purpose as Chuck, sort of this larger-than-life person surviving out there.
Yeah, and especially at his age, too, now. Because this was just, not that long ago when that was made.
Yeah, but this would have been, I don't know, probably 15 years ago now.
It probably was like 2002 or something. But still, I mean, Schwarzenegger was still up in age.
It was the late 90s.
Oh, was it? Was it really?
It was after T2.
Oh, well, yeah.
So it was in that period before 2000, I think.
Well, anyway, Schwarzenegger was still older at that point. So.
And he needed to be older.
But yeah, oh, yeah.
Barring him, if you could hook up somebody to do this movie, who would you, director, cast, who would you?
Director and cast? Well, cast Harrison Ford as Neville.
Yeah, especially now.
Yeah, or even 10 years ago. He was still old enough, then. Modern directors, I don't know, because some of the ones that I like for different reasons, but I don't think they'd be right for this film.
Like Tarantino.
Yeah, Tarantino. I love Tarantino's stuff, but he couldn't make this movie, It would be a very, very different movie.
I think it would be interesting to see what he would come up with to do this movie.
Well, it would be interesting, but it would be a very different movie. The more subtle aspects of it need, to be handled right and handled lightly. Yeah. I mean, it could go on and on with that and try to think about, who would play the roles. Because then you got to come up with the Zerbe part, the Matthias part. And it's got to be somebody who's, and same thing, a little older, experienced, who's been around, who's friendly. Of course, that's the role. They're playing the newscaster, but you got to have somebody closer in age for that role. Because they have to, when they sit down to have the, you know, the trial or the meeting and that interrogation, they have to be kind of equals, you know, for the weight of it to work. So it's not just some young guy mouthing off to an old guy.
Wait a minute. You don't want to know who just popped in my head.
Oh, shit. Who?
I just, for some reason, it was just Pacino in those robes.
Neville!
You're dead. You're dead, Neville. You're dead. The other, I thought, just because he is great at playing a villain, and that would be Christopher Plummer.
Oh, well, yeah.
It would just be a lot of fun doing that, you know.
Yeah, and I'd buy him as a newscaster, too, you know.
Oh, yeah. But he played Mike Wallace.
Well, there you go. There you go. Now, when was it, the first time? Do you remember the first time you saw this movie? Because I do. I remember the first time I saw it.
HBO.
Really?
I think that was the first time, the early days of HBO.
Wow.
I think it's the first time I saw it.
I remember.
I think I may have seen it on TV before that, but.
Yeah, I remember this had to have been the late 70s, like 78, 79, somewhere around in there.
Isn't that when HBO started, 78?
Well, it might have been, but we didn't have cable yet. And this was staying up late watching Dr. Madblood. And I remember
I probably had to watch it over at Rob's.
Oh, well, this wasn't on Dr. Madblood, though. I don't remember what was playing that night, but I remember my best friend at the time, a guy named Keith Witt, we were both the same age, and still, well, I think he was a year older. And I remember we watched Dr. Madblood every Saturday night, you know, and he was staying over, and he told me about, we was looking in the paper, and this movie called The Omega Man was coming on after Dr. Madblood. So this was probably like 3 a.m, you know, or two in the morning. So, and he was telling me he had seen it before on TV and was describing it to me. I'm like, well, we got to watch this. It sounds cool.
And you saw Chuck was in it. And you went, well, that it's done.
And that was it. That was it. And I remember being glued to that thing and loving every minute of that movie. And then the ending, I was like, man, you know, just not being distraught, but just like, wow. Kind of was a big deal to me because the hero died at the end and that wasn't supposed to happen, you know. And I've loved it ever since.
Have you ever seen that little interview with Tim Burton where they ask him about a favorite movie and he picks Omega Man?
No, I read about that. I didn't see the interview, but I read about it. Yeah.
Oh, see, that's on YouTube too.
Isn't that cool?
And he says whenever it's on, he can't help but watch it.
Yeah.
He walks in a room and it's on, you know, he has to sit down and watch it.
Yeah, but it's so. one of those movies though, like that, you know. One thing we said we were going to talk about, what we didn't though, was the kiss.
The Whoopi Goldberg
story. And I saw this the night it happened. I happened to be watching her show. So when she had that talk show, it was just called Whoopi, right? It was late night.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She had Chuck on as a guest, and Chuck was making the talk show rounds at that point for some reason.
But he was in one of his books.
Was it one of his books, or was it before he was writing the book? Well, no, he wrote a bunch of books, actually.
Yeah, but it was may have been the one that in the arena, I think.
Oh, okay.
It was that one that he did the children.
Yeah.
The one he kind of made for his son.
Yeah.
Or his grandson.
But it was way before An Actor's Life, though.
Because
that's the one that we got
no,
when it came out, I thought.
That's in the arena. Actor's Life is the one from the 70s.
Oh, okay.
With the journal.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, regardless, he's on the Whoopi Goldberg talk show, and then she brings up Omega Man, and seeing that on-screen kiss when she was younger was a big, not so much influence, but was a big deal to her. As a young girl, a young black girl watching this movie and seeing this legend, you know, that she had grown up watching in other movies, Charlton Heston, and having this on-screen kiss with this black actress. And she made the statement of something to the effect of, do you think it was a big deal then? Do you think it's still a big deal today? Or, you know, hope we've gotten past that, or something to the effect of, do you think it's that big a deal still. And right. I remember he did that thing where he grabs his jaw and like he's thinking. He said, and he looked at her and said, well, let's see. And he leans over and plants one right on her. And she was like, oh, she was like, oh, my God. She's back fanning her face after it was over. And she's all flustered. And she says, oh, my goodness. Oh, gee. And he's kind of grinning. And she's like really, she turned into like a 16-year-old schoolgirl at that point. she says, we have to go to commercial. We'll be right back. Oh, good. It's like. Really freaked her out, and but in a good way, surprised her, yeah. And she was just like ecstatic after that. She got kissed by Moses.
Yeah, kissed by Moses. And look, and this movie fit in with his two-syllable part of picking characters.
Oh,
you realize it, Neville.
Oh, Moses, Neville, Taylor. Yeah.
Penny, Khartoum, Ben Hur, El Cid.
There you go.
Earthquake. That's why he turned down Meteor.
Oh, Meteor.
Now, I don't know if he turned down Meteor or not.
Well, if he was, he's a very wise man.
That's right.
Man. I've got the Blu-ray of this, and it's a gorgeous print. It looks great. Good job on it. It's, you know, beautiful to watch. You know, heads and shoulders above the old VHS copy that was around.
Right. In the extras, they have that little behind-the-scenes thing that they shot at the time where he's talking to the
animal. Yeah, the little featurette, yeah. I was hoping for a little more in the extras. There's no commentary, but usually the commentary is like from the director and one of the lead actors, and you know nobody's around. I think Paul Coslow is the only one, and the kid that played Richie. I mean, of course, the little kids, but of the adult actors, the kid that played Richie is an adult now. He's on the little intro, and so is Coslow, but they're it. Because Chuck's
and Brian
gone.
Fauci.
Well, yeah, he had a big part in it.
Rosalind Cash, she's dead, right?
Yeah, she's gone, and Heston's gone and Zerby's gone. So
Zerby's gone.
Yeah.
Seagal's.
Yeah, I believe it. He's been gone for a while.
Yeah.
And then again, just to kind of jump into subject a little bit, this is one of those that, you know, it's such a fun film and so fondly remembered, but there's really nothing out there on it. I mean, there's the I Am Legend book, and then they did a recover on it that said, you know, real small I Am Legend, but that said now made an animation motion picture of the Omega Man, real big on the cover.
And
I need to get a copy. I used to have a copy of that, and I don't know what happened to it. I need to get a copy of that sometime. I need to find one. That and then the one sheet. That's really about it as far as if you're looking for memorabilia on it.
Yeah, I sent you photos to post online of the poster art, the foreign poster art.
Oh, yeah.
From this. There's some cool posters. So
yeah.
Those are neat if you were collecting some of that. But, yeah, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be photographic.
Yeah, one sheet in the press book. That's about it, really.
Things like that. There was no toy gun with a flashlight attached or anything.
Now, there is a custom set of Matthias and Neville action figures in a nice little shadow box display case that were handmade. And
oh, yes, yes.
And yes. One, numbered one of one. And they had to be sitting on my shelf right over there.
You could get that, you know, the big, the Mezco Taylor and, you know, the bare chested one or the one where he's got the space suit and, fix that up and do one of him.
Yeah. So. That's what I'm going to do. Costume. I'm going to do it at a convention. I'm just going to get a blue jumpsuit and get an army hat and a machine gun with a light on the end of it and walk around as Neville.
and Phillips can just come as the albino.
Yeah, we'll just pasty white with a black robe. We'll just walk around.
Yeah,
that'd be awesome.
You got to come with the spear in your chest. Chuck loves these roles where he gets to hold that blood bag over his heart and just spew blood, doesn't he? Figure real quick, Khartoum, this, Beneath,
yeah. Well, it's a surefire way to go. I mean, gaping, seeping chest wound does it every time.
That's right. If you got to go, you got to go. That's right.
Anyway.
Have we used up all our time?
I think we are coming to about time on this. And, I mean, you know, what else is there to say? But except we ran down the plot and then the things we really like about this movie. You know, it's got some minor flaws, but there's nothing I can really say bad about it. You either like it or you don't. And some people tend to giggle a lot of time at in any movie, especially stuff where it dates the movie. But that kind of stuff doesn't bother me. I get in the mindset of when a movie's made, and that's kind of how I watch it unconsciously.
Yeah.
You know, so that
the people that you look for what is good in a movie like this, and yeah, there are things that could have been better and
yeah,
more finely tuned. Like the script could have been a little better.
Yeah.
It's probably, I think, the weakest part of it is the script. And it's a fun movie, and a lot of people just have very fond memories of, like, when they discovered a movie like this. I think that's what's important.
Yeah, I mean, it's a popcorn movie, and, you know, or
yeah,
stay up late at night and watch a movie. And,
yeah,
and it works. It works on that level, and... You know, like I said, I can't really say, except for nitpicking minor things, I can't say anything bad about it. And, you know, I urge anybody listening, if you have not seen it, seek this movie out. Watch it. Love it like we do. If you like Charlton Heston, you know, you'll love him in this. If you like grindhouse drive-in sci-fi / horror movies from the 70s, this is one of the best. And it's readily available. I do believe it's still out on Blu-ray and DVD, so it's real easy to find. And, you know, once again, if you like what we're doing here, or you don't, or you want to tell us to shut up, or you want to say good job, drop us a line at the Phantasmo email at phantasmoad@gmail.com. That's phantasmode, all one word, @gmail.com. Or on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page, very easy to find. Drop us a line there. Well, I guess that just about does it for this episode.
So when do I get paid?
You're breaking up.
You're breaking up.
We're losing the satellite feed.
always a pleasure.
Oh, yes, sir.
I hope we entertained.
We entertained each other, if nothing else, for about an hour or so.
Yeah. Well, I'm spent. I need a wet nap.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm done. Well, yeah, we'll have to get back, get the satellite link up and working again and do a few more of these. I know we've got some other topics we've talked about in the future.
Oh, yeah.
I know one we're definitely going to do, and I don't know when it's going to be, maybe closer to Halloween, but we are going to, Clayton and I are going to talk about the Karloff Frankenstein trilogy, which will probably be a two-parter, at least, I would imagine. If not, a three-parter. We'll see if people can stand it.
Yeah, really.
But on that note, hey, thanks for calling in via satellite here, and we'll do another one soon. And to everybody else,
oh, yes.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.